bad about
you
personally.
Thank you all heard Senator Cotton apologize for his outburst earlier. Thank you very much, Senator. We'll call the meeting of the Senate Hess Committee to order, and I will note for the record, I was in the building early, but I don't know what happened. Senators Cotton, Menard, and Sturzelewski on hand, we do have, would like to ask Senator Duncan to join us at the table. We're going to hear from Senator Duncan regarding the progress of the Health Care Task Force, and then we will be hearing two bills, Senate Bill 335, the Council on Handicapped and Gifted, and that will be up first, and then Senate Bill 215, the Prison Population Management Bill. And Jim, why don't you tell us what's going on and with the committee, because we do have a number of bills before us, but have really waited rather than proceed on those until we had the information back from the committee.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. You don't want me to go into a lot of detail.
No,
right,
but just to give us some sense of where you are, and you do have a specific process you're going to be following, and then have a timetable, as I understand, for getting back to us.
That's correct. As you're probably aware, and I'm sure other members are aware, the task force was appointed at the end of last legislative session, and it's somewhat of a large task force. It has 18 members on it. Six legislative members, three of the Senate. I serve on Senator Collins and Senator Gratula, three House members, Representative Barr, Ellis, and Boyer, and then 12 other members. Three of those are administration members, and then I've got the list here, so I wouldn't forget it. Two providers, one who represents the insurance industry, one who represents nonprofits, one who is just a consumer of health care, one who represents private business people, one who represents the Native Health Services, an individual who represents labor, and one who represents medically indigent. So it's a very large task force, and we try to cover all possible areas, although we find that there are folks who still would like to be on it who aren't. But we've, throughout the interim, had several meetings. We got started kind of late because the fiscal note on the task force, as was fiscal notes on all other task forces, was vetoed. So we were struggling for a while to determine how we could get some funding to move forward. And Representative Barr from the House side, the House Finance Committee, committed to fronting the money, and we'll be looking to get that repaid to him during this legislative session. So we were able to begin. We had three or four meetings during the interim, two-day meetings, primarily in Anchorage. We finished up with one here in Juneau just before the session started. During that period of time, we did a lot of listening. Primarily, had a number of people come before us to talk about the issue and explored a lot of different areas. And reaffirm some of the figures that we had found in the previous task force about the level of uninsured people in the state, estimated at 90,000. The total expenditures in the state estimated at $1.5 billion. And then found some other interesting figures, such as the uninsured people, 55% of them are employed. They're probably small businessmen or are in business.
55% of what figure?
Of the 90,000.
Of the 90,000?
The 90,000 are small business people or business people. A third of them are children. So we've identified probably the two major areas of people who are uninsured in the state, and we really need to move forward in that area. We haven't recommended, there will be a report coming to the House and the Senate and the Governor by February 1, a preliminary report on what we've found and what we see as some options to address the problems, but it is not really a final report. We were required by the resolution to have the report to the, actually I think it's February 15th. Excuse me, have a report by February 15th to the legislature. There are a number of options before the legislature right now. I have a piece of legislation in, Senate Bill 83, which deals with cost containment and also access. Senator Collins has a bill, Senate Bill 242, as I recall, that deals with small market insurance reform. Senator Cotula has a couple of pieces of legislation, Senate Bill 73 and 74, I believe it is. So there's several pieces of legislation before us. We're not ready yet to recommend that any of those bills or that we take action on that legislation. Instead, we want to do some further in-depth work over the next 2 months and then come back to the legislature. In addition to those four proposals that are before us, before the legislature in bill form, the provider community came forward at the last meeting with their proposal for major reform. They've entitled it CHIPRA. I don't recall what that stands for. Comprehensive Health Insurance. I don't know what it stands for. But they came to us with their proposal. And I think that was a positive step and an important step, because we now have a proposal from the provider community that addresses access and cost containment to some extent and major reform. We had a variety of proposals that are before the legislature are all on the table, so we have a starting point where we hopefully can come together with some type of consensus and then be able to move forward. The provider community probably does a lot more than any of the proposals on the table that the legislature's put in does. They, for example, tie it somewhat to the permanent fund dividend as either a funding mechanism or a requirement to have insurance before you receive the dividend. They talk about tort reform and a few other things, which we all know are pretty difficult issues to address, but at least they've come forward with a proposal. The goal is to try to bring some consensus by March 15th, and we've scheduled several work sessions, February 1st and 2nd in Anchorage, that's a Saturday and a Sunday, February 4th, 15th and 16th in Anchorage, which is also a Saturday and Sunday, February 29th, I guess there's a 29th this year, right? February 29th and March 1st, also in Anchorage, and then a final work session day here in Juneau on March 14th, and then a committee meeting on March 15th to take formal action on what we can recommend back to the legislature for action this session. It's our goal to try to bring consensus by mid-March, and we believe we can, that we can move forward with some legislation. We can make recommendations to the legislature, hopefully move forward with it. And if we have consensus among the parties, it seems that we've solved a major problem and hopefully can take some action. So it's an optimistic goal, but one I think is somewhat achievable, especially since we now have the provider community and others at the table with us talking about the issue and how we might resolve it.
Jim, are you anticipating those will be kind of full two-day meetings of your group?
And we're anticipating, yes, that we're going to be starting, like 9 o'clock on Saturday morning and running till 5, and we've right now tentatively said we'll start like on one Sunday and run through the afternoon, but it looks like we've got more work to do. We intend to start and do a full day on Sunday. The task force, the public members, and I had a meeting with them early in January in Anchorage. They wanted to meet and discuss where we were going. They were becoming a little bit frustrated, and I appreciated that we were listening a lot, learning a lot, but not doing anything. And they said they were on the task force to do something, so they've committed to putting in the hours and the time. I think it's important.
Now, I'd appreciate it if you would copy the members of this committee with the schedule. I'm going to attempt to sit in on as many of those as I can, because when you reach consensus, that's going to give a very short period of time, and I would think that possibly some of the other committee members, if they're going to be there or want to go, might want to sit in on that just to get used to the issue, because they're really complex, and you've got a very difficult task to bring people together. But I would certainly want to see some progress made, and it's an issue that's complex, like mental health. We're not going to have one meeting and have it all agreed. So if you could do that, people might like to attend. And are there questions?
There was supposed to be a memo, there was supposed to be a memo from Representative Ellison that went around. It should have been out yesterday. Maybe it's coming out today.
Oh, maybe it went to everybody.
That lays out the schedule. It should have gone to every member of the legislature.
I don't believe I've seen that. That's good then.
I will check with Nancy.
Thank you. Any questions?
Comment, Madam Chair, that it is an area that is very complex and has a lot of windy roads, but the bottom line is that there's not enough people that have access to health care in that whole process. But as a personal note, as a small business person that has a health plan for his employees and all this business, we went through the scenario this last year where one of the participants in our group, a young couple, had their first child. The child had a heart defect and went through the whole series on and by the time it was all said and done, the medical costs were $150,000 in 1 year. So consequently, we got a 34% increase in our whole group health care. So that move, when we were paying for a couple and a husband, a wife, two children, and a family, it was costing us about $400 and some odd dollars a month for the health care. Now that's gone up to, I think it was $600 and some dollars a month. So those kind of things affect small business and trying to put that out. We did an appeal to the carrier. The analysis came back from the person from the state that looked at it and said that, well, they paid out $145,000. We paid $68,000 in premiums during that period of time. Therefore, they adjusted the rates by 34%, and they go ahead and do that. But what that does is it puts such a burden on there. So some people that are working for me that are making, for example, $14 an hour, we're paying $7 an hour for healthcare on top of that.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's gonna, you know, drive us out, cost of fillings, you know, so much. But you know, there's only so much in the competitive area that you can go on, because there are some people that don't provide the healthcare access, and it drives the cost up. So it's a big burden. So
and I think that's what we're finding. And you know, as I said, 55% of the people are businessmen, small businessmen. And I think we need to address that. What I've found is, I've talked to a number of small businessmen, is they can afford it, or they could at one point afford insurance, and they would have it. They have access to market, except the same thing happened to them, it happened to you, so they've had to drop out. We need to, I think there's a variety of ways to address that problem we're looking at.
Go ahead, Senator Cotton.
Well, I'm happy about your optimism, Jim.
I'm always optimistic.
I know.
Well, that's good. The only question I have is, are there people or groups of people or interest groups that are have got their heels dug in already and are saying no way?
Yes. Well, I don't know if they're saying no way. You know, at one point, Senator Cotton, of course, the provider community, which I thought was just kind of saying, we don't want to participate, no way. They have now come to the table with a proposal. And their proposal is very wide-ranging, and I think stirs up a few hornet's nests that weren't stirred before, right? So it creates more problems in one way, but helps resolve a problem in the fact that we're talking. For example, we have never, ever put on the table tort reform. Malpractice, cost of malpractice insurance, undoubtedly is a cost of doing business for providers. I mean, I know when you were Speaker of the House, you were pushing very hard tort reform.
I found out that the lawyer lobby was stronger than the oil lobby.
Right. Well, and I think we've kind of laid that out to them. Clearly, that's a very strong lobby. We're not sure that we want to, you know, we don't want one thing to sink a good package. So we're going to make a good faith effort to see if there's something we can't do in that area, and we're going to work on it. But I think everyone has to go into it with their eyes open, realizing that some of these areas are real difficult. They're going to take a long period of time. You know, tying it to the permanent fund dividend for either eligibility or as a method of funding. That's another, you know, stone around the neck of healthcare reform. So we all have to be willing to.
Has the legal community put you on notice that there's no way that there's going to be any kind of reforms involved with the malpractice or
no
system?
You really haven't had that issue. Just came back
right.
again
right.
in
right.
in the very recent.
Well, but we discussed
yeah.
that last
no,
year.
No, I know,
talked
but
about
it's surprising
how
they
an
haven't
approach
it
would
forward.
Have to be as comprehensive as possible.
Yeah.
They have not. I think primarily because there's been no legislation submitted to do that. One, they may now become very active. And you know, honestly, the provider community laid out, I think, 8 things that they wanted us to do in tort reform. We'd done 1 or 2 of those already. I'm not an expert in this area, but I recall we've done 1 or 2 of those things already. So the state has moved forward in some regard, and we're going to be looking at what some other states have done that hopefully will help out. But it's a major area. I think, though, what's interesting, and it's going to be a difficult job for us to resolve it. What's interesting is most people on the committee are saying everybody's going to have to participate, right, in some extent, which includes attorneys, if we're going to resolve the problem. Now, whether we can get that package put together. The other thing, of course, where there's still somewhat of a misunderstanding, and I think we've tried to get the provider community wanting everything in one large bill, and of course, we've said to them, that's not constitutional, undoubtedly. We can't do that, so we're going to have faith that if we put in 4 or 5 pieces of legislation, we'll try to push them the best we can, but one shouldn't kill the whole package, I don't think.
Senator Hoffman has joined us, and I've asked Senator Duncan to do his best shot at identifying those bills that are in both the House and the Senate that very likely will be in the final consideration. So I hate to hold up all the health-related issues, but on the other hand, moving ahead is not going to be particularly productive, I don't think, in time.
Yeah. In fact, if I might mention that, appreciate that. We have not the authority to do this, but it would be our recommendation, the task force recommendation, that the committee should just wait until we figure out what the consensus is, if there is one.
Otherwise, we followed along with what you're doing, but until it comes together, it might look very, very differently. Mm-hmm. Particularly interested in the remarks that Senator Menard made, though, that in some kind of approach for the small business firms, they're really having trouble, and we get information on that all the time. So that's a real key component, I think. Are there any other questions?
And just one further one, to your point, these are work sessions. These are not formal committee meetings, so they're not going to be teleconference, but any member of the legislature is urged, if they're going to be there, to come and participate in those work sessions. They're going to be informal type, roll up your sleeves, let's do some work then. So.
Thank you. We will now consider Senate Bill 335, the Council on Handicapped and Gifted. This is sponsored by Senator Duncan. I've put on your desk committee minutes from February 22nd and February 26th when we had Senate Bill 52 before us, a very similar bill that was before us last year, went through the legislature, went all the way through, and was vetoed. The bill is back before us with some minor, well, I guess a major change, and it's before us today. Senator Duncan?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Let me go through the bill very quickly, and this is kind of deja vu, I guess. We were discussing this last year, and despite the fact it was vetoed, I didn't put this in your folder, but just to let you know, finally, when the bill did leave the Senate, we had a position paper signed by a couple of officials from the Department of Health and Social Services supporting the legislation, saying they did support it. Unfortunately, from April 24th, when that was signed, to when the governor vetoed it, something went awry somewhere along the line. Senate Bill 335 is basically the same bill as before you last year, with one exception. Last year, we had in Senate Bill 52 a provision that the council would appoint its executive director, and that is necessary to comply with federal guidelines and to qualify for federal funding. It is not in this piece of legislation. The reason why it is not in this piece of legislation is because that very provision, which the administration objected to last year in Veto 52. For appears in Senate Bill 65, which we passed and they signed into law, which is the Mental Health Land Settlement Bill. So that provision is taken care of elsewhere, and we do not need to put it back in this bill and risk another a veto. So we have complied with federal requirements by allowing the council to appoint its executive director. Senate Bill 335, then, should be, I think, a non-controversial bill, and I believe there is a position statement in favor of from the department. Sure, they're here to speak to it. The state's definition of a developmentally disability will be changed to conform to the federal definition that will be contained in this legislation. The present state definition prohibits aid to severely physically handicapped individuals who require many of the identical services as mentally disabled persons who currently qualify for state assistance. The state will be allowed to provide these individuals with such benefits as respite care, daycare, homemaker, community living services to both physically and mentally disabled once Senate Bill 335 is passed. Also, the bill increases the number of members on the council from 23 to 26 to allow for, again, a federal requirement, composition changes, which the federal government requires. The council will then be able to serve as the interagency coordinating committee for the 1986 Federal Education and Handicapped Act amendments. The planning for the needs of the children from birth to 3 years will be entrusted to the council, along with their current planning mandate for older individuals. Also, you might note the legislation changes the name of the agency at the request of the council to the Council on Disabilities and Special Education in order to more precisely reflect its responsibilities. As I said, there is a zero fiscal note also from the department, and as far as we can tell, the only provision that was objected to last year is no longer in this legislation.
Fine. Are there questions of Senator Duncan? Join us at the table. Mr. Bergstrom, you're just available. Do you have any comments? We do have your position of support.
Yes.
All right. No additional comments.
I think maybe I'd like to say a couple words about
Yes, please. Identify yourself and go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. Nice to be back for another year. My name is Tom Bergstrom, representing the Department of Health and Social Services. One concern last year when this bill was out is that obviously it's going to add a number of people served by the state, yet it has a zero fiscal note. The reasons for that are twofold. First, we have an existing waiting list, and it would be unfair to those individuals to have a fiscal note which would cover these persons and, in effect, leapfrog them over the existing waiting list. And second, we really have no idea how many people are involved here. Senator Duncan was kind enough to give me our position paper from last year, and I noticed one aspect of it which spoke to that waiting list and noted that there were 400 people on the waiting list. This past year, we've made an intensive effort to discover exactly who those people are on the waiting list. To say there are 400 people on the waiting list, I think, left the impression that there were 400 totally unserved individuals in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Frankly, the department had in the past done a sloppy job on that waiting list. We made an intensive effort, and we find that rather than 400, there are slightly less than 200. And within that 200, it also gives the impression we're providing no services. There are, in fact, 11 services that the department provides, and the 196 are receiving some, are asking for but not receiving one of those 11 services. So it's not as if they are totally unserved. The vast majority of those are vocational rehabilitation. That's 134 of the 196. So I did want to mention a couple of words about the waiting list and about the fiscal note, but if you have any questions.
Okay. Are there questions? Tom? Thank you very much.
Okay.
I'd like now to hear from Mary Catnaw, who is the chair. Welcome, Mary.
Morning. I appreciate the opportunity to speak. This hearing is scheduled concurrent with an executive committee meeting that we had today. I wanted to take the opportunity to speak in support of Senate Bill 335 and just to highlight a couple of the issues. Obviously, we were disappointed last year when the bill was vetoed. However, sometimes things turn around from the best. It did allow the council to finalize a process we've been going through for several years, and that involves the council's name. For several years, we've been asked by constituents to consider changing our name, as the term handicapped is considered offensive to some. It's, the term has been changed in federal statutes. The ADA is one example, and even the Education for the Handicapped 94-142, when that was reauthorized, has been changed to Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. It was very difficult for us to even go through that process. We tossed out lots of different names, because when you've assumed an identity in a state for as long as we have, there was a lot of fear that if we changed our names, people would wonder, well, who are you, and all that kind of thing. And just coming up with a name that seemed to fit everybody's views and the issues that we represent was difficult. But we did come up with a name that I think we all feel real comfortable with. There's been a little bit of concern expressed that the proposed name, the Governor's Council on Disabilities and Special Ed, might seem to eliminate gifted. However, we talked that through. In federal statute, gifted is not mentioned as part of special ed, but in Alaska statute in 1430, it is specifically addressed as one of the categories. And so we felt that the likelihood of it being moved out of that statute in the near or even distant future is fairly remote. Felt comfortable with leaving the name just specific to special ed, because it is addressed in that statute and in the rest of our statute. So that was one part. The issue of expanding our membership to 26 members, I wanted to just remind you that allows the council to continue and formally assume the role as the ICC. The federal statute creating inter-agency coordinating councils, 99457, authorizes services to children or persons from birth to six. In this state, our existing statute already picks up services for children ages 3 to 6. So we're talking about a population of 0 to 3. Obviously, the state could go through a process of creating a whole separate council that mandated to have 15 members, which would be pretty costly. And I think more importantly, it sets up, you know, there's this little pocket and people are representing this age group, and then there are people representing this age group. Whereas if one council assumes the role of all folks of this constituency, ages birth to death, so to speak, then it's a little bit more economical. We've already added a legislator to our council, our existing membership, and through just looking at the membership, we feel that we can accommodate the requirements of that law with only adding 3 new members. Lastly, the definition, just want to support getting the state in line with the federal definition, which is more on a functional basis than listing categories. And already some of the folks that were not mentioned in our state statute through special ed, we were already serving deaf students and visually impaired students. We're already picking up some services for those. Mm-hmm. We want to thank the department and the legislature for the support that allowed, I think, a number of the people that were on the waiting list for one or more services to come off that waiting list in the past year. And I think that accounts for the reason why those numbers are a little bit lower this year.
Good. Very good. Are there questions of Ms. Gavin? Thank you very much. Was there anyone else that wished to be heard on Senate Bill 335? If not, we'll close the public hearing. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Madam Chair, I move that the Senate Bill 335 be passed out of committee.
We have a motion to pass the bill out of the committee. Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. The next piece of legislation. Is Senate Bill 215, and it's an act relating to population management in the state correctional system. This bill was introduced at the request of the governor. We did have one hearing on the bills last year. You have those minutes. It was on May 4th, very late in the session. And so the bill is back before us. And Michael, Ms. Dark, are you here to represent the administration on this piece of legislation? Would you join us at the table? We'll declare the public hearing open. We do have in the packet, I'll point out, some proposed amendments. We did not bring forward a committee substitute, but those will need to be considered. And go ahead, Mr. Stark.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Michael Stark. I'm an Assistant Attorney General and counsel to the Alaska Department of Corrections, and have served in that capacity for nearly the last 12 years. Madam Chair, let me ask your preference. Indeed, I did make a presentation to the committee last May. You were dealing with the mental health lands issues
right.
at that time, and I'm not sure whether it would be useful for the committee members for me to begin again as if you had not heard about this bill.
My feeling is that yes, it would. Unless, would the committee object to that we actually get a good presentation on it? What's your feeling?
I don't understand what he just said.
Well, what he said was, I guess what you said was, did you get enough information?
I gave a summary of the bill. You didn't have much time last May, and I gave a summary of the bill, but I know you were dealing with mental health lands issues at the time, and understandably were preoccupied with those issues, and so I thought it might be advantageous for me to begin again, as if you had not heard of this bill.
That's fine. I thought he said as if we hadn't heard of the mental health bill.
No, I'm sorry.
No.
I didn't get the
We
connection.
Heard that frequently for months.
Thank you.
No, I think we need to start. And
I agree.
I'm also interested in your presentation. If you can tell us, we heard last year of lots of things that were going to be happening in corrections about a change in corrections and various studies and is this as pertinent as it was last year, and kind of what's the situation out there?
Okay, perhaps I can address those issues very briefly to start with.
All right.
There have been a number of studies that the Department of Corrections has invested in. Principally, they've hired a consultant to prepare a master plan for them, which started off initially just as a plan dealing with population projections and where the department would be going in the next few years in that area. That master plan has expanded to cover really all aspects of the department. And in fact, just this week, today and tomorrow, the department is getting its initial recommendations from the master plan consultant, who is Chris Murray and Associates out of Seattle. I don't know if any of you are familiar with him. And my understanding is that the department will, in its presentation to the finance committees and finance subcommittees on corrections, will be addressing some of the recommendations of the master plan. There were a couple other studies that they did. One was a validation study in the classification system. There have been concerns, appropriately so, in the legislature and in the department that not enough of the department's community residential center beds were being utilized. And so there was a validation study to determine if, in fact, inmates were not being overclassified so that a sufficient number of them were not being put into the community. That has been, at least an initial study has been conducted. I'm not sure if it's been finalized. And the recommendations do involve a modification of the classification system so that more prisoners would be classified at lower levels. That compared to other states, at least, and the federal system, our prisoners have been overclassified. So I think we will be seeing some changes in that direction in the next few months also.
All right. Just the comment. The reason I asked that to be brought up was that I wanted to have a sense of whether what you're proposing and what you're doing is going to have an impact on this piece of legislation. And that's because there was a lot of concern. We had presentations at the committee, at the subcommittee, on this very question of soft beds and the shuffling of people that seems to be going on.
It, as I will explain, I don't think it in any way minimizes the need to adopt this bill. It does minimize the likelihood that it will ever be utilized.
Utilization of the
yes.
bill. All right,
yes.
That's the distinction. Senator Cotton?
This has to do with that study. May I ask a question?
No, certainly.
Related to the legislation. The department, for the last couple of years, has felt they needed another facility, or at least an expanded facility for women.
Yes.
And one of the outcomes of the study was going to determine if that really was the case, considering the possibility that more soft beds would be used, and perhaps as a result of that, there would be less of a need. What's the conclusion? Is there a conclusion there as to whether the women's facility is still needed or the expanded facility is still needed?
What is expected, and I have not heard what the recommendations are going to be on that issue specifically. I did speak with Mr. Murray last week, and he indicated they were developing their recommendations at that time, and they'll be presented, as I said, today and tomorrow in Anchorage to Department officials. There will be one of two recommendations I think we can expect. One was the question of whether or not there would be a need to be a new facility. The other was whether there would be an ability to retrofit an existing facility or part of an existing facility for women. So I think we will see one of those two recommendations still come forward. It is possible that the recommendations in the master plan will enable the department to readjust its population so in order to enable to free up part or all of an existing facility for women. I still think there will be some capital costs involved, but obviously, if that's the direction that they recommend the department feels it can go, it wouldn't involve anywhere near the cost of a new facility. But there is an obligation also in the Cleary final settlement and court order that the department develop either through the use, of an existing facility or a new facility, a facility for long-term women that's capable of handling long-term sentenced women up for the next several years. And which the department, at least presently as it exists, is not capable of doing. So I know that in talking with Mr. Murray briefly, he suggested that there would be ways to expand space at additional facilities without new construction. It would involve expanding staffing, perhaps renovating or redoing sewage treatment plants, those kinds of things, which have been limitations on the number of inmates that can be at exist certain facilities.
Well,
Senator
Cotton. Yeah, and I won't pursue this now. I'd like to talk to this fellow here that's making a presentation today to the Department of Corrections in Anchorage.
In fact, he will be here Friday. My understanding is that Department of Corrections is meeting at 8 a.m. on Friday with the House Finance Subcommittee on Corrections, chaired by Representative Ulmer, and that Mr. Murray will be attending and may well be addressing that subcommittee Friday morning.
Good enough.
We'll send out a notice on that meeting. We're not having a meeting here. I'm coming back in too late to schedule one, but at least to sit in on that session. Or I could schedule, if there's interest, a later presentation to this committee. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On population management, I guess we had put in additional soft beds in Bethel to try to get more people into the facility so that there's more, so that the people can go back and work into the community more and more. But I have received a letter that was written to Richard Franklin and say the trend is is in reverse of that, and he says that of some misdemeanor felonies in the misdemeanor furlough category, a total of 26 placements, 23 were under 30 days, and of the 28 confined misdemeanors, 21 that were placed in the Tundra Center were for under 2 weeks. 13 of the 28 were under 5 days. And the reason that the people operating the facility see that the system isn't working, first, longer-term offenders from the region are sent to other institutions around the state and are not processed back to the region before their release. And the second reason appears that there's a reluctance on behalf of the institution out in Bethel to the Bethel furlough officers and perhaps other institutions to make any placements other than for the shortest term possible. For whatever reason, for this happening, offenders from this largely native region do not appear to be able to access community residential programs with the same consistency as offenders of urban locations. And it seems as though if this is the case, that there's some injustice being done. And I was wondering if you might want to comment upon that, since we do have this bill trying to facilitate our population management. It seems as though the interest is more in concern of dollars and keeping them in state-operated facilities and not trying to use the programs to get people back into the community.
May I respond to that?
Yes, please.
Senator Hoffman, I think that's a very valid concern and one the department has shared, which is why they did two things. One was, again, the validation study of its classification system. They suspected, almost to the level of knew, that they were overclassifying their prisoners. The problem is it's a matrix system. It's objective. Values are assigned. And rather than helter-skelter reduce custody levels of prisoners, they wanted to take a systematic look at the classification system itself and see if there was some way to reevaluate the different factors that go into individual prisoners' custody levels so that the custody level assigned to prisoner would be more accurate and reflect the threat that prisoner represented. I think we will see from the changes that the department anticipates making that many more prisoners will be community custody level, will be put out into community residential centers for longer periods of time. And that ties into the second thing the department did, which was establish a number of task force, one of which was a community residential center task force. All this was represented on that task force, as were all of the other providers in the state, as well as the department and some victims groups. And I just myself reviewed last week their recommendations, which were, I think, approximately 30. And it was a very well-reasoned set of recommendations. The department has to determine how it's going to implement them, and there may be a bit of a time lag in doing that. But one of the recommendations also was making sure that inmates that are placed in community residential centers are put out there a longer time before their release, that it should be at least 4 to 6 months and not 30 days, so that they have time to integrate back into the system, to go through the phases of the community residential center program, to be employed, to have better ties to the community when they're actually released from custody, to help prevent the level of recidivism that we've seen in the state. So I think we will be seeing some positive changes.
Could you comment as to whether this review of the classification study and the attendant recommendations is going to be made a part of the master plan?
Absolutely.
So that when we get a presentation, will that be in there?
So that is my understanding, that the results of the classification validation study, which were presented in a preliminary fashion to the department, were then given to the master plan consultants to incorporate into their final master plan.
Senator Hoffman? Fine. All right. Why don't you go ahead and go through the bill as though it were newly born then? And let's understand.
Okay, may briefly give a little bit of background as to why the bill is before you. Talk about the bill and then, with your permission, talk about the amendments that are also before you. As stated in Governor Hickel's transmittal letter on this bill, the prison population in Alaska has grown at a tremendous rate over the last 10 or 12 years. This has caused, as you are aware, substantial problems and interfered with the state's ability to really comply with the constitutional dual mandate of reformation of offenders and protection of the public. The department could indeed do a much better job in that area if the population pressures were not what they have been. Also, as you are certainly better aware than I, the problems in the Department of Corrections, which have been pushed by the population pressures, have resulted in significant resources being expended on new facilities. Also, as you know, a major class action suit, the Cleary case, Cleary versus Smith, was filed back in 1981 and was finally settled more than 9 years later in late 1990. That settlement avoided some significant litigation and exposure for the state in a number of areas, one of which was the overcrowding area. Another principal area was the mental health treatment of inmates. And in addition, established a number of steps that the department must take, to deal with its consistently overcrowded institutions. The settlement requires the state to do, or to seek legislative enactment of an emergency overcrowding mechanism. And this bill is that effort to comply with that requirement of the settlement. Until the bill is passed, or if it is not passed, the department is bound by certain requirements in the settlement, which require the department to stay under certain capacities, and if those capacities are exceeded for more than the permissible periods of time, then the department has to report back to the court. The court has the authority to order certain remedies. It can close down prisons. It can set limits by which no more prisoners can be put in institutions. It can order the release of prisoners. It can do any variety of things. While the enactment of this bill will not in and of itself solve the prison crowding problem, its passage will do a number of things. One, it will preclude the court from getting involved, ordering any remedies as to the prison system. It will permit the executive and legislative branches to exercise their discretion, which is granted to them by the Constitution, to manage the prison system. It will keep the court system out. That is a very significant concern that the department has, and I think that hopefully you share as well, that the courts have no business managing the prison system. We would like to get them out. Passage of this bill will do that. It will also provide a breathing space, particularly in light of the fact that the administration supports this bill, but only if the legislature will adopt a sunset provision. The administration does not view this bill as being a permanent way to solve the prison crowding problem. Before you, one of the amendments before you is a sunset provision, and which would have the terms of this bill be repealed in, I believe, July of 1995. And what that would do is provide then a short-term emergency relief mechanism, which would provide the legislature breathing space in which to allow the Sentencing Commission to exercise its statutory responsibilities and come back to the legislature with any recommendations it may have as to solutions for long-term solutions for the prison crowding problem, and give the legislature time to act on those recommendations if it so chose. So, with that brief introduction,
just a second, certainly. Senator Cotton.
Well, what happens then? The court order remains, isn't that true?
Obviously, 3 years down the road, if this bill is adopted, we may, depending on what the legislature does with any recommendations from the Sentencing Commission, depending on the recommendations of the master plan, how they've been implemented. Certainly, if this bill is repealed under the Cleary order, the plaintiffs would have the ability to go back to court to seek remedies if the bill is no longer in effect. However, what the department would anticipate and would hope that, combined with any action by the Sentencing Commission and the legislature, the master plan, that there would not be the overcrowding problems then that exist today and that have existed for the last several years. If that were the case, the court would not involve itself, even though it may well have the authority to do so. The court's not going to step in just for the fun of it. There has to be a problem to correct.
So this assumes, the sunset date then assumes that there won't be a problem.
And obviously, 3 years from now, if there's still a problem, we can come back and talk about it then. There is always the possibility of extending it. Yes. What I would do is using the flow chart, since, and I think you all have a copy in your...
You all have
the file before you. It would be helpful for you to follow through. What I'll do is summarize how the bill would actually operate if it were adopted. What this is, just by way of again by summary, is a two-step mechanism or approach to deal with prison crowding when the prison population for the entire state system exceeds It's maximum capacity.
Go ahead.
When the proposals in the bill, the mechanism here is not unique in that a number of other states have adopted similar approaches to deal with the prison crowding problem. What is unique is that this is a two-step mechanism, and I'm not aware of any other state that has attempted to propose a front-end mechanism, if you will, and a back-end combination. And front-end mechanism in dealing with prison crowding is trying to slow the inflow of prisons. That's a true front-end. We actually don't have that. But what we have is dealing with the prison population in the front-end or the early part of incarceration. The back-end, obviously, is dealing with getting prisoners out of the system a little bit quicker. And this is a combination, and after I describe the bill, if you will, and if you desire, I can certainly explain the advantages of having a two-step approach, but very quickly, if I can run through the flowchart with you to show how it would work. Starting on the left-hand side of the flowchart, if the average daily population exceeds the maximum capacity for 30 days, that means the entire population for the system, not any one particular facility. And that's the clear advantage of this bill over the present requirements in the clearing order. We have requirements as to each individual facility, caps for each facility. Anytime they're exceeded, we have to deal with that problem. This bill requires that the population for the entire system for a 30-day period, that's the average of the 30 days, exceed the maximum capacity. Once it does, then the Commissioner of Corrections would notify the governor and the parole board that we have essentially a prison crowding emergency. And at that time, the commissioner would then have, the department would have 15 days to prepare a list of prisoners that would become eligible for what is known as special discretionary parole. And if for the 15-day period following that, the maximum capacity of the system is still exceeded, then the first part of the mechanism would kick in. If during that 15-day period the maximum capacity drops below, the prison population, drops below the maximum capacity, the emergency is called off, nothing happens. Additionally, if, as you can see on the diagram, if new beds become available or will become available within 45 days after the overcrowding emergency is declared, also the emergency is called off, nothing happens. And new beds can become available in a number of ways. Either there's facilities under construction or simply through contracting for more beds. And that may well be CRC beds, which would enable prisoners to move out of our prisons into the community residential centers. So if any of those things happen, the emergency is called off and the mechanism does not take place. If, however, for the 15-day period following the initial 30-day period, so now we're talking about 45 days, the maximum capacity is exceeded, then certain prisoners, excluding our most serious offenders, excluding all A felons, all unclassified felons, and the more serious B felons, they are not even considered. But considering the remaining, those certain property B felons and C felons, prisoners who have been presumptively sentenced, in other words, they are not presently eligible for discretionary parole, considering that pool of prisoners, if they have served half their sentence and meet certain other criteria, they would then become eligible for discretionary parole and would be looked at by the parole board. That in no way guarantees their release into the community. The parole board has a certain matrix, as you may know, that looks at average periods of months that usually are served for certain offenses. They obviously look at risk to the community. You may be aware that our parole board is a very conservative board. The risk of the rate of recidivism for prisoners that are paroled on discretionary parole is very low, certainly compared nationally. At any rate, the parole board would look at these prisoners and parole those who they deemed were safe risks to the public. 120 days after the emergency is declared, that last 30-day period of that 120 days, we look at that, and if at the end of that time frame the maximum capacity of the prison system is still exceeded by the prison population, then and only then would the second part of the mechanism kick in. And that is then the commissioner again notifies the governor and the parole board and prepares a list of prisoners who would be eligible for what's known as early release. Now, that's a misnomer because prisoners aren't actually just released. What happens is prisoners who are within 120 days of release would be released within the next few months anyway, again, excluding all those serious offenders that we talked about, and again, who meet a number of other criteria. having served at least half their sentence, no detainers, no disciplinary problems, basically people who are a fairly safe risk and who are going to get out into the community anyway in the next few months, then within 5 working days, the commissioner would order those people released into supervised probation or parole. Now, they would go into probation or parole depending on what their status would be when they were going to be released anyway. So if they were going to be on parole, then they go released on parole early. If they were going to be released on probation, you look at what their sentence is, then they'd be released on probation early. And one of the amendments that you'll be looking at is one that the House Hess Committee adopted, and that is that in releasing these prisoners into supervised probation or parole, any of them who have 30 days or more remaining to serve would be required to go into community residential center. And I think that makes good sense and would encourage you to seriously consider it. So that only those prisoners, again, who have 120 days or less would be even considered, would be released here. They would all be released into supervision except for those with 10 days or less. Those people would simply be released in the community because they're going to get out in 10 days anyway. Those who have more than 30 days, again, if you adopt that amendment, would have to go into community residential center.
That's page 5, line 20. Let's take a look at the amendment sheet there. You discussed the first one, with the sunset clause. That's page 7, line 11. And then the one you've just discussed of the Hess Committee, is that page 5, line 20?
That's right. Actually, the three proposed amendments on this one page all relate to
that issue.
Yes, they all would accomplish that.
Under this,
Senator.
Under the system that you're talking about here on page 3, does the capacity of the system, does that include the community residential center?
It does not.
It does not. So that there could still be spaces available in those facilities and you'd still be releasing people?
That is one possibility. However, again, if I may, and I know we're running a little out of place, but it seems appropriate now, the final page amendment is also an amendment adopted by the House Hess Committee and clearly states the legislative view, and I think obviously you share it, Senator Hoffman, you do, is that this is an extraordinary remedy to reduce prison crowding, and it's expected the department will exhaust all other available options before this bill would ever be utilized, so that clearly those community residential center beds would have to be filled.
Which amendment is that?
It's one on the final page, the third page.
No, it's the second one, isn't it?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Legislature views.
Okay, I've said different
extraordinary remedy. That's on the second page of what we have. Page 1, line 10, is that the one we're talking about?
That's right, I'm sorry.
Right.
Page 3 of the bills, as presently exists, obligates the commissioner, I'm looking at line 8 through 10, obligates the commissioner to discuss with heads of the executive and legislative branches alternatives for reducing the population anytime we reach this 30-day maximum capacity.
Well, why wouldn't it be simpler to put in that the maximum capacity shall include the CRCs?
The problem with that is that different populations, as you know, different institutions have different missions. And there may be a time when the problem is not with the community custody inmates. Because the community residential center beds may be filled, and still we have problems with the medium or close or maximum capacity prisoners. The additional problem is that, as you know right now, at least all our community residential centers are operated by the private sector. Those are not state facilities. And at any time, a private contractor could go under, for instance, could go bankrupt. We lose those beds. The state doesn't have much control over it.
Then those beds wouldn't be figured into the maximum capacity if they don't exist.
Should that cause this prison overcrowding emergency to occur is the question. Because those prisoners are still part of the system. If you include the CRCs, you also have to include the prisoners that are in them. Right now, the prisoners are not included either. Prisoners that are in the CRCs are not included. Only the prisoners in the state facilities. So it goes two ways. I mean, that is certainly something we can examine, but it is double-edged because those prisoners are also included. And
they are the responsibility of the state. So it seems as though that they should be included, because if they're not, you know, if they're not in those facilities, they're going to be in state facilities.
True, but the principal reason also, and I'm sorry that I didn't mention this earlier, the principal reason that it was decided not to include the community residential centers is even when those facilities are crowded, you don't have the same conditions or pressures or tension that you have in our hard beds, in the correctional centers. People in CRCs are getting out in the community, they're working, they're going to school, they're staying there at night essentially, they're going to counseling, whatever they're doing, but they're not in a essentially lockdown situation. So they're not really in the same class of facilities as our correctional centers. The bill would still work, I think. You know, the mechanism would still work if you wanted to include them, but I think there are good reasons to consider treating them separately. Your concern, obviously, is one that you're afraid the department is not going to utilize those beds.
They aren't utilizing them.
There's no question that that's true. I would encourage you at least to hear about the recommendations in the master plan and what the department will be doing as a result of that. But, you know, certainly, you know, the committee's pleasure on that issue, sir.
Do you want to pursue that right now, Senator? Senator Cotton?
Could you give us some quick stats here on the capacity of our system?
Yes, sir.
The population and the percentage or number with 120 days or less to serve.
I don't have the numbers of inmates right now that would fall within that 120 days or less to serve. That's certainly something I could get from you. The department could come up with that information, I think, on short notice.
Maybe it isn't even necessary. I'm trying to figure out, you know, how many people are going to be involved here that are going to become eligible for special parole.
Okay. When we looked at this, and it's been a couple of years now since we looked at the numbers, I don't think that they are going to change that dramatically. There were approximately, as I recall, 250 or so inmates that fell into the eligibility category. And the parole board then would look at them if and when we ever reached that point and determine how many they would parole. The parole board typically, I think, paroles around 35-40% of those who are eligible that they see. So if that number were to hold, then we'd be looking at somewhere in the area of 100 or so inmates that might be released on parole during that 120-day period.
What about prison capacity and population?
Okay, right now, the capacity of the system, the maximum capacity of the system is a little bit over 2,500. And the department has an emergency capacity right now, which is not relevant to this bill, but which came out of the Cleary court order. And maybe I could take just a quick minute to tell you how that works. The maximum capacity is arrived at by looking at a number of criteria, the principal one of which is square footage in the living areas and how long the inmate spends in that living area. If they are locked down more than 10 hours a day in their housing unit, then they are entitled to greater square footage. If they are locked down less than 10 hours a day, so they have movement throughout the facility and the program areas and so on, which the lower custody levels have, then there's less square footage. So the maximum capacity is arrived at by looking at those factors, staff, inmate ratio, a number of other things. Then you get an emergency capacity by looking at all of the special beds in a facility. These are the temporary housing areas, segregation units, intake units, those kinds of things, which are not designed for the normal housing of prisoners, but which are utilized in special situations. You look at the total number of special beds in a facility, and you take half of those and add that to the maximum capacity facility, and that's where you get emergency capacity.
Which is?
Right now, 2,562. So you add about,
2,562 is the emergency capacity.
Of the system, right, of the prison system.
And then the population?
Population right now is a little bit over 2,500. Is right around the maximum capacity. Just to let you know the nature of our problem, I have the figures for Monday, January the 20th, and there were three facilities which exceeded the maximum capacity on that day, two which exceeded the emergency capacity, and four others that were at or within one inmate of the maximum capacity, out of 15 facilities. So even though the numbers in the prison system actually are down over what we would have expected a year and a half ago. We're still pushing, as you can see, right around the max capacity. Now, fortunately, the system itself is not over the max capacity, certainly not for a 30-day period. And also, as you know, the winter months are the high months. So when, by the time we hit March, the population relaxes off again until we hit next October.
But you're faced now with a situation where you're having to deal with individual institutions as far as court involvement. So if you exceed the emergency capacity of an individual institution right now for 30 days, then you have to take action.
Is for a 10-day consecutive period or for 30 days in a 90-day period, yes, then we have to take action.
So what I understand is going on is that you make sure that doesn't happen. So if Institution A is about to reach the magic point where something has to happen, a prisoner gets transferred over to someplace else in order to beat the time requirements.
That is the way the department approaches the problem. It also is working with the community justice agencies in the different communities. Bethel, for instance, is the one facility, the Yukon Custom Correctional Center is the one facility where we actually exceeded that level back in September, where we exceeded the emergency capacity for more than 10 consecutive days. And the director of institutions for the department went out and met with the local Superior Court judge, district attorney, and they managed to develop some procedures that helped lower the prison population. Right now, the population at that facility is back up again. And
but did not use the soft beds that are out there to resolve the problem.
Well, that actually is what they did do. They utilized those beds for pretrial detainees. You're right. We still have the problem until the changes to the classification system are implemented. The present problem of CRC beds not being fully utilized exists. There's no question.
You know, I want you to keep doing that because, and I think the rest of the population, I mean the prison population, the rest of the population would be pretty displeased if you just started putting people indiscriminately into these soft beds.
Absolutely. It needs to be done responsibly. It needs to be done, but it needs to be done responsibly.
Have you, when you use your maximum capacity and population, are you taking in soft beds in that part of it? Those are, I see. Okay.
What about those numbers, if I could just get you?
Yes, go ahead.
So we've got a prison capacity of 2,500 plus, and you don't give us a number on that. It's just a little over 2,500.
I didn't bring the exact number.
Okay. I guess we can get those.
It's in the low 25, yeah.
Yeah. And the emergency capacity, 2,568. And we're a little above the regular capacity right now as far as population is concerned, a little better than 2,500. So,
right around maximum capacity.
Now, what about these CRC beds? Is there a certified CRC bed, or is there a moving target out there? Is there an actual number of CRC?
There are a specific number of beds the department contracts for. So I think around 275. Now, another...
Total in the whole state.
Yes. And another reason why those beds are not included in the system and the maximum capacity is that a significant number of those beds, approximately 20%, are utilized for probationers and parolees as halfway in-house beds as opposed to halfway out-house beds. In other words, probationers or parolees that are having difficulty complying with their conditions of supervision, rather than simply go take them to court and ask the court to revoke their probation or parole and put them back in prison, we have them spend, the probation or parole officers will ask them to spend 30 days in a halfway house or 60 days, undergo counseling and so on, and if they do well, then put them back out on probation or parole. To include all those beds in the prison system would be improper because they're not all used for that purpose.
How many day beds did you use last year for that purpose?
About 20% of the beds that were used are used for that purpose. I don't have the exact number. I can tell you that since December, the number of community residential center beds that have been used has gone up quite a bit. When I looked last, it was sometime last week, there were approximately 235 or 240 of those 275 beds that were filled. That is good. It's much better than last year. I know last year that number was right around 200, 190, and which, as you know, as we're paying for 275 beds, it's a shame. I mean, it's a waste of that resource, and there are prisoners that could be in those beds. And the department, as I said again, is going to determine which ones should be in there and get them in there as soon as they can.
One last question here, just on the same subject, on those CRC beds. If there's 275 now, and say 240 are being used, what if there was suddenly a demand for 300? How readily available would additional space be to the department?
I think it's more a question of funding. My understanding is some of the private providers out there, a number of them have additional space that they could have online in fairly short order if the funding was there to pay for it.
Senator Menard, then Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On those soft bids, in the state's contracting for the 275, are they paying for, is the state paying for them whether they're utilized or not?
Yes.
Yeah. And there's no difference in the rate whether there's a person there or not.
That's right. Obviously, if certain beds are left empty, then the per day rate for the people who reside there is higher. Mm-hmm. We're paying the same amount irrespective because mm-hmm. they have to staff it. They, you know, the facilities are ready for those inmates. Mm-hmm.
Senator Hall.
Well, I'd like for you to explain to me how this particular piece of legislation is going to meet the second half of the constitutional goal of reformation of the offender.
Obviously, there's no direct relationship that if we have fewer prisoners in the system, that all of a sudden prisoners will be reformed. But if you have visited the facility at Bethel, I don't know if you had or some of the others, then you can understand that the program resources are limited in those facilities. And those are the resources that are directly related to reformation. Obviously, you can't make a prisoner reform, but you can give him the opportunity. You can provide programs, teach them job skills, education, those kinds of things that will, we all hope and we know, affect some prisoners so they don't come back in. When the prisons are overcrowded, those resources are diluted. People can't get into the programs. There's waiting lists. Sex offender program is an example. Education, counseling, alcohol, drug counseling.
So this particular piece of legislation isn't doing anything for reformation. It's just looking at it's being looked at because we're pushing the maximum capacity in the system.
Respectfully, I think it is doing something for reformation. It enables inmates to get access to the programs by assuring that over an extended period of time, the prison system is beyond maximum capacity. It will relieve that pressure, and the pressure not only for program access, but the tensions in a facility when they're overcrowded and inmates are not getting access to rights or privileges or programs that they're ordinarily entitled to. There are fights, there's violence, inmates are injured. We've been fortunate that no inmates ever been killed.
But the focus of this legislation is to give the department the ability to address the upward trend of maximum capacity of our facilities.
Certainly.
You know, it seems as though that is the purpose of this legislation, and it doesn't seem to be, just managing people, what you're doing here. You're not doing much more.
Right now, in our overcrowded system, inmates get out of prison, serve their sentences without having been adequately treated or having had adequate access to programs. This bill will, if and hopefully it will never be needed, but if and when it is, it will enable inmates to get better access to the program so that when they are released, they will have less likelihood of committing further crimes.
Those people that remain in the system.
Yes, yes.
All right, are we ready to move along here? No, that's fine. I mean, it's a complex issue, and we spend a lot of time. I'm really interested in what they're coming out with, and we all had concern and saw a very rigid classification system. Senator Hoffman raised some very good points about what works with the Native population, and I want to see those answers too. So I appreciate the time that's being spent on this.
If I may, just a minute or two on the classification system, and perhaps it'll help you appreciate the problems that the department faces. The classification system that's in place is one that was developed with consultants from the American Correctional Association approximately 7 or 8 years ago. It was in response to allegations in the Cleary lawsuit that there was not an adequate classification system. What we had, back then was a feel-good system. There wasn't an objective system. Inmates were classified depending on how the staff at a particular facility felt on a particular day. If they liked a prisoner, then they made him a lower custody. There was no objective system at all. And you can imagine the problems that caused. Inmates were transferred from one system to another. They went from minimum custody to maximum custody because staff felt differently about them at different facilities. There was no system. And we objected to a adopted an objective system that was based on the federal system at the time. Since that time, the federal system has changed. The nature of the inmate population has changed. When I first took over the job I presently have in 1980, there were 700 inmates in our prison system. There are now over 2,500. And if you count the inmates in the CRCs, there are over 2,700. We have over 300 murderers in our prison system, you know, 300 or 400 sex offenders. That was not the situation 10 years ago or 12 years ago. And it certainly wasn't 7 or 8 years ago when we got our classification system. It needs to be fine-tuned. There's no question about it. The CRCs were fully utilized back in the early 80s. Mm-hmm. That hasn't been the case the last couple of years. The department realizes it has a problem, but it wants to address it in a responsible way so that it can adequately protect the public. We all know that if they put the wrong person in a CRC and that person went out and murdered somebody or raped somebody, that the public backlash may well destroy the use of CRCs altogether. And then the state is faced with the idea of having only hard beds for prisoners, and we know how expensive that is. So the goal of this bill is really a recognition that Alaska cannot afford to keep spending large amounts of money building new prisons. The bucks aren't there anymore. Again, to preclude the court from interfering with the management of the system, that's a significant goal, I think, and to provide a temporary breathing space for the Sentencing Commission to come forward with its recommendations and to see what the legislature does with those recommendations. And I think the amendments that are before you, and I would ask you to please consider them, particularly the sunset provision and the provision providing for the requirement that on the second half of the mechanism, inmates have to go into community residential centers if they're released, that all those provide many, many safeguards. We're not even looking at the more serious offenders in this bill, if it's ever needed. And again, if it's adopted, it may never be needed. And if it is needed, only the safest prisoners would be addressed. The parole board is a screening of those for the special discretionary parole. And on the back end, if you adopt it, the CRC adds further protection. And I think it's a responsible approach to dealing with the problem of prison crowding, which, as we know, is not going away. It's here, and it has to be dealt with. And unfortunately, if the legislature doesn't deal with it, then sooner or later the courts will deal with it in a manner, I think, which will be less advantageous to the public and to the executive and legislative branches.
Fine. Are there further questions of Mr. Starr? Okay, thank you very much. Commissioner Horetsky, do you want to have any comments, or are you here to listen and learn or observe? Mm-hmm. Does the committee feel they need additional information on this, or in a sense, what is the pleasure? There was a request for possibly, I don't know if Senator Cotney wanted more specific information.
Well, I'm interested in hearing more about the master plan and mm-hmm. the classification study. Hopefully there's not a big rush on the bill. I just don't feel comfortable moving the bill out today. I just, like, if somebody made me stand up and walk through this flow chart, I'd probably mm-hmm. probably flunk the test right now. I could probably struggle my way through it if I compared it to the bill. And I appreciate the fact that we've taken the time to do some of that today. Yeah.
I'll tell you what. Let's how about proposing this, and maybe Mr. Dart has some comment about the immediacy of it. I will check to find out how much of a presentation is going to be made. It may be that we will want to have a presentation before this committee also, and unless we can, you know, get the information on Friday. And go ahead.
If they're going to meet with the House Finance at 9:30, does that mean that
8 a.m.?
Oh, at 8 o'clock.
Yes.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
But if you could get the information, and if not, we'll schedule them at a very early date to come before us. And I would hope that Senator Hoffman and Mr. Stark can talk in some detail about this question of the soft beds as to what the implications would be on both sides. I don't feel that this particular legislation is going to solve that classification question, but I also understand that classification is one where there's very significant interest on the part of the of a number of legislators, not just the ones around this table. Senator Hoffman?
Well, I believe that if you're looking at managing the population, if you're forced to go ahead and take into consideration the CRCs, you're not going to do that, then I think you're not really managing the total population, and thereby forcing the administration to take a close look at those events, because I think they're useful and are providing a functional purpose. Mm-hmm. But presently, the administration, at least in my region, is not utilizing those beds for that purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I would like somehow for those beds to be taken into consideration, so the department has to go through that step. You know, it's so easy for them to say in the second amendment, it doesn't say anything about them, but it says that they should exhaust all aspects. You know, I think that if we want to
strengthen that particular part,
we want them to go through that loop, go through that process, and take into consideration those soft beds, and be explicit about it, so that those beds are being utilized. We are paying for them, and they are very helpful in my part of the state, and I want those beds to be utilized.
Senator.
And just I don't disagree with you, but I do agree with the current policy of being conservative about using those beds. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to be feeling a little more confident about the decisions after a classification study, well, then I think that's the time to address that. And in the meantime, mm-hmm. I'm sure you don't want to take a chance of putting a dangerous person in one of those situations either.
No, but the people that I've seen that are in the beds, and some of the people that are in the correctional facility, aren't dangerous people. You know, I went through, you know, they have to go through their blood samples when they leave and when they come back. And for the most part, the people in the facility that are Alaska Natives are a very different type of person when they're sober. You know, and the crimes that they commit out there, some of them are felonies, but many of them aren't. And those beds should be utilized. I don't want those people to go out and cause additional problems into the community.
Yeah, I'll share that. I
but just in discussion, though, that got into the whole question of the rigidity of the current classification system to be able to handle those. Or at least that was the response, wasn't it, Lyman, that was mm-hmm. given to us, that they couldn't handle those discreetly. So that's why I think we need more information on what that system is and whether it will take that in and automatically handle that.
Well,
but it may be that we could bring in something here that would call for, a report or an analysis of the ability to utilize the soft beds.
Madam Chair, I think the concerns here are all valid and certainly shared by the department as well. The one question that comes to mind, though, is that if we include the CRCs, and this may not be the only approach, we may be able to resolve Senator Lyman's concerns, Senator Hoffman's concerns, without including those beds in the maximum capacity. But if we do include them, then the proposed amendment, which is requiring prisoners who are released at the tail end, if they ever are, to go into CRCs, wouldn't work because those beds would already be full.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's an area we have to explore more. We can't resolve that around this table. So my recommendation will be that we get a presentation either by attending the House or here on the classification study, that there be further discussion on the question of particularly what they're recommending on soft beds and how it relates to that we plan on bringing this issue back before us possibly midweek next week and see if people are comfortable on acting on it.
Well, one final comment. I think the Sentencing Commission is also going to be taking a look at many of the problems of why we have overcrowding. You know, there's a cost factor the state of Alaska has to bear, but if we just look at the Sentencing Commission and not look at the benefits of what the soft beds are providing the state in reducing the reoccurrence of crimes, plus all the savings that the state is benefiting by, you know, maybe we should be expanding that whole program, you know, and then, and by us not even looking, not even utilizing that program to its fullest capacity presently, you know, it doesn't seem as though we're addressing the problem.
Just that I think we will be addressing the problem in the near future when the recommendations of the classification system are implemented. There's no question, again, that you're absolutely right. And if something needs to be done, and it's the department's full intention to do something in response to the problem. If I may, Madam Chair, the amendments that are before you, would it be at all worthwhile to have them considered so that when the bill comes back before you, you have a working draft of a bill that includes those?
What's your feeling on that? I was going to bring that up about the proposed amendments. We could certainly have a CS. Would there be objection to the idea of just to come to consider it, but not action to including the effective date, the sunset? Would you object to that?
No, you could put them all in as far as I'm concerned if you wanted to. If the chair is comfortable with them, and obviously you have to adopt them as an amendment.
Well, it seems to me that the place that there might be some changes would be page 1 or on page 1, line 10, but on page 5 and page, I think that would be line 4 and line 20. If you wouldn't object, we could make a working draft of this and then have further discussion that might affect page 5, line 4, and line 20.
It's fine.
Senator Hoffman? Mm-hmm. We'll go ahead and do that as a working draft. It's not adopted by the committee as yet, but we'll get it before us.
I'm a little bit confused because we're talking about this fellow, Mr. Murray, who's going to present his master plan.
Yeah, I'm not sure the extent of the presentation he's going to make. But
what they've just completed, though, is a master plan, or they're working on this master plan.
Right, his initial recommendations are being presented to the department today and tomorrow in Anchorage.
Right, but what about the classification study? Is that a separate effort? Is that underway?
He has looked at that. The department was presented. They had two consultants from the National Institute of Corrections do the classification validation study.
Oh, so that's been done?
That's been done, and a draft report was prepared. I haven't seen it. I've heard about it. I've heard of the number of the recommendations. There are many. The conclusions were that our system is overclassifying prisoners, and they came up, I understand, with specific recommendations on how to deal with that, how to adjust the factors in our matrix system so that more prisoners would be moving down through the system. Actually, there would be, I understand, a few more prisoners kicked up into maximum custody. Which is a very small percentage anyway. We're talking about 2-3% of our population. But that in terms of the medium, minimum community custody areas, there would be considerable number of prisoners moving down. My understanding is that the draft recommendations were presented to the master plan folks to incorporate that in the overall master plan.
Well, in that case, I do recommend that we get a presentation for this committee.
All right, we'll work on that.
I don't mind going to the House committee meetings, but I think it'd probably be appropriate for us too.
Yeah, I think it's something. There's been a lot of questions, and they'll either be here or they'll be in finance somewhere along the system. So we'll check that out, and we'll contact you. You can tell us how to get a hold of whomever we need to get a hold of. So this issue will be back as soon as we can resolve that, and also find when we can have a meeting. It may be that I would ask. Maybe we can have a Friday meeting, even though I'm not here, and we could schedule it. That's the only time we'd be able to get it, because I think it's important we know more about this. Anything else to come up on this? Thank you very much, and we'll hold open Senate Bill 215. Before the committee breaks, I wanted to ask if there. Right now, we're taking a look at all of the school financing bills. We've got lots of things in, including your legislation. I want to get a sense of where people are on that. We've got a good number of issues, all big ticket items. We'll need to address those. You've heard a bit about the health legislation, and that affects a lot. There's a lot of big issues before us, and many of those we can't necessarily move on right away. But I did want to know, is there anything particularly the committee would like me to bring in terms of overviews? I don't want to do a lot, but I do know that Family and Youth Services has changed now to quote-unquote, strengthen the family, but in the presentation we had, it was very short on what those programs were going to be to actually carry that out. And I'm hearing a lot of comment where there's concern about, well, does that mean that we get kids back in abusive situations because we're not getting enough services? I don't know if that's an area. Certainly this corrections is one. But do you have any other issues that you particularly want to take a look at?
Well, Senator? I think that there's going to be, you know, I don't know whether this is going to happen or not, but I think there's a lot of interest in that foundation formula being increased. And I keep hearing rumors that the House is going to pass a bill on it to jack it up to 63 a year.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that happens, who knows? But what I did last year was I had one of the folks in the Department of Education formula give me a remedial course on how you
figure that,
how you understand that darn formula. With, pardon me?
Pretty complicated, isn't it?
I couldn't. If somebody made me do it right now, again, I'd probably flunk that test. But the bill I've got in on that on class size is I recognize is, you know, kind of an mm-hmm. ambitious approach, mm-hmm. and so I've got another bill that I've been working on that that would have an effect on the foundation formula,
mm-hmm.
that would throw a class size factor into it. And I haven't introduced a bill yet. I'm not quite satisfied with what I've gotten so far, but that's an area that I'm gonna pursue personally, and if maybe the committee's interested in having overview on foundation.
Yeah.
Because okay. Every time anybody talks about that, they go, oh, wow, it's such a big deal. We can never approach it. It's going to take 10 years to resolve it or to fix it or to change it. And we all know there's been mm-hmm. political amendments over the years. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've seen them happen on the floor of the House where somebody stood up and actually, you know, added something,
right,
or changed something, yeah, to benefit their particular district. And
we used to do that totally by, you know, a certain percentage of. I'll tell you one thing that I do believe we should have, and we could particularly ask for comment on the foundation, but the governor, or through the governor's direction, Commissioner Covey has really moved into setting up a huge committee, kind of Alaska 2000, and it's broken into, I'm just getting preliminary information, I think some of you have been asked to serve on that committee. Four areas are getting into finance, into accountability, into a number of areas. And in discussions I'd had with the commissioner, he had talked about the whole issue of the foundation and of the approach to capital funding for schools, as well as these other issues, coming back, but not coming back to this legislature. They're just getting underway. So I do believe that's one where we should have a presentation. There's an absolute ferment going on in legislation right, or in education right now. It's just amazing. There are special programs, a grant that we got, I think, 1/6 nationwide. Steve McPheeters is talking about principals, mentoring principals, and there are, we have a WISE project in Anchorage. There's a major project, again, where the Anchorage school district and others got to look at the whole question, and a big interest to me of this zero to kindergarten program and how we integrate Head Start into the school system so we don't lose kids. Apparently three of our boroughs, North Slope, the Northwest, and the Bering Strait, are actually integrating those early childhood programs into the whole educational system. And I'm starting on a project. I don't foresee legislation coming, but working, we've got Head Start over with Community and Regional Affairs, and you saw just where the president that's put another $600 million into that program, and there's some opportunities, although the state has to match that. But then we've got certain early childhood stuff over in DOE and health and social services. I'd like to see us take a look as a committee at that, but I'm just getting information on it now. But a lot of stuff is going on in education that is broader. But what we have is a brand new Board of Education. As you know, under Barney Gottstein's leadership, they had developed a series of outcomes, what a kid should know, and then they were starting to get into the whole question of curriculum development. a new board grappling with all of these same issues, and a huge committee appointed. It's very large, all the people involved. And
you're
so
start over.
Yeah. So we're starting all over again. And again, that makes it hard if we come up with changes here. I think we're going to have an awful time getting administration support. I just point that out because I've really been doing a lot of looking at what's going on. The exciting thing is that things are happening. We're seeing the business community into a number of partnership programs. There's just ferment and change everywhere, which is very positive. But I don't see it in anything we necessarily get our hands on. So
that's unfortunate because, you know, that's what we're here for. And, we can be on all the dang committees we want to be on.
Yeah, but it's not going to solve the problem.
Well,
yeah.
It's like everybody else. You know, I'd like to do something.
Yeah. All right. Let me get a presentation on the Alaska 2000.